This is feeling like some gossipy reality TV instead of a science committee that is critically important to the health of children.
Welcome to the Rolling Forward Podcast.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
I'm Dr. Alicia Rowland.
And we're both clinicians who do research. I'm a psychiatrist.
And I'm a pediatrician.
In our last episode, we talked about how HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired all the members of ACIP, the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, and brought in new voices. And we go into some detail about who those voices are, what their backgrounds and qualifications are. This episode, we're going to tell you what actually happened at that first ACIP meeting, which just finished today.
If you haven't listened to our last episode, I really recommend it because it gets into some of the details about what the ACIP committee is and how their decisions impact access to vaccines. But essentially, they are a committee that gives recommendations to the CDC that help build the vaccine schedule in America.
And part of how they do this is through these meetings that they have a few times a year. Now, the ACIP has met during this administration. However, this is the first meeting since RFK Jr. fired everyone, and it's back with entirely new membership.
And that's not the only controversy about this meeting.
It's not. So, Alicia, let's start up with the mood leading up to this meeting.
For a committee that probably has really never been in the media before, I feel like the ACIP has been blowing up for the past few weeks.
It's been all over my newsfeed, and certainly I'm a person who reads health news, but even so, ACIP has never really been a thing before.
So RFK Jr., as we said, decided to unilaterally fire all 17 existing members, and then he handpicked 8 new members for this meeting without any type of oversight or review of these new members. Following this decision, the American Academy of Pediatrics decided to withdraw and is boycotting the meeting.
Which is significant because for decades, organizations like AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, have worked to shape policies around vaccinations through ACIP. But what they've said is that now with this major change in membership, they no longer see the ACIP as a credible process. And they say that they will not lend their name or expertise to the system that is being politicized at the expense of children's health.
In a recent press release, they said that they will continue to hold its own vaccine schedule that is, quote, rooted in science and grounded in what is best for children to remain healthy.
So this is a major separation of AAP and ACIP that have long worked together. So that's already one major point of division. Something else that happened before this meeting is that the 17 former members who were just fired wrote a viewpoint in a major academic journal called JAMA, or the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Quote, as former ACIP members, we are deeply concerned about the destabilizing decisions made without clear rationale, and it may roll back the achievements of the U.S. immunization policy, impacting people's access to life-saving vaccines, and ultimately put U.S. families at risk of dangerous and preventable illnesses.
And as all of this is happening, Dr. Bill Cassidy, as well as Patty Murray, who are both members of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, they called for the meeting to be postponed, given these concerns about the new members. Now, this is notable to me because Bill Cassidy, he's a physician. He's the chair of this Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. And it was his vote, his pivotal deciding vote in that committee that confirmed RFK Jr. nomination to then move forward for Senate confirmation. So it was his vote that really allowed RFK Jr. to become the secretary of HHS. And in providing that vote, Dr. Cassidy said that he was concerned about some of RFK Jr.'s views around vaccines and said that he had private meetings with him and he was reassured that RFK Jr. was going to be following the science and that Dr. Cassidy would get these special meetings with him.
Do you want me to play that quote?
Yes.
I have it pulled up.
Oh, you do?
I do. I'm prepared. I have receipts.
It was such a moment.
Mr. Kennedy and the administration reached out seeking to reassure me regarding their commitment to protecting the public health benefit of vaccination. Mr. Kennedy and the administration committed that he and I would have an unprecedentedly close collaborative working relationship if he is confirmed. We will meet or speak multiple times a month. He has also committed that he had worked within current vaccine approval and safety monitoring systems and not established parallel systems. If confirmed, he will maintain the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommendations without changes. CDC will not remove statements on their website pointing out that vaccines do not cause autism. If he is confirmed, HHS will provide a 30-day notice to the Health Committee if the agency seeks to make changes to any of our federal vaccine safety monitoring programs, and Health Committee will have the option to call a hearing to further review.
Ooh, those were some receipts, because already it sounds like there's a parallel process happening between AAP and ACIP. It sounds like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has entirely changed the membership of ACIP, though I guess technically it's still intact. And not only that, when Dr. Cassidy says that this meeting should be delayed, guess what? It wasn't. It moved ahead on schedule the way that RFK Jr. intended. So you decide for yourself what to make of that. But certainly those receipts felt like karma coming right back.
And the day before the ACIP meeting, it was brought up at the House Energy Committee on the Subcommittee of Health, where Representative Schreier actually brought this up directly.
Of course, here's the thing. Vaccines only work if you actually give them. And we know your record on this. We rely on the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, a panel of experts, to recommend which vaccines people should get at which ages and the like. Now, I know Senator Cassidy had concerns about your views on this. And so when he voted to confirm you as Secretary of HHS on February 4th, he explained that decision by saying that, quote, if confirmed, you will maintain the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices without changes. But then 2 weeks ago, you fired all 17 experts on that very committee. Mr. Secretary, question for you. Did you lie to Senator Cassidy when you told him you would not change this panel of experts?
I never made that agreement.
So are you saying that Senator Cassidy lied when he was on the Senate floor, lied to the American people?
I didn't see that statement by Senator Cassidy. I've only heard it from you. But if he said that I agreed to it, it would be inaccurate.
There's some tea there.
I feel like we just played the clip. Like, you listen, you decide who's telling the truth, who's not.
It's not doctored. You can see it directly on YouTube from Bill Cassidy's.
And it's wild that this is the CDC. We're talking about the CDC group to recommend vaccines, not Love Island, right? Like, this isn't like Love Island, like he said that I said, but I said that he said. And then you see the camera go back and like replay what actually happened.
But I heard the rumor the first time it came out of my mouth.
Yeah, this is how like I'm feeling that this is going. This is feeling like some gossipy reality TV instead of a science committee that is critically important to the health of children.
And yet, this is not the only controversies.
Oh, no. Oh, no. It continues.
It continues. The day before the meeting, on June 24th, one of the new handpicked 8 members resigns.
Wait, it's not even started, and he quits.
He quits. And according to a Health and Human Services spokesperson, he, quote, decided to withdraw from ACIP during the financial holdings review required of the members before they can start to work on the committee. But it seems like he had some financial disclosures that he didn't want to make, and so said goodbye.
Wasn't this supposed to be the group that didn't have a conflict of interest?
Oh, one of the members had to report a conflict of interest every time they voted.
Ooh,
spoiler.
Juicier.
On top of all of that, at the same time as the meeting was started, RFK Jr. announced that he was removing all funding from Gavi, the Global Vaccine Alliance. It's a global public-private partnership. It helps vaccinate children in the world's poorest countries. And RFK Jr. cited concerns over Gavi, quote, ignoring science and mishandling vaccine safety. The U.S. previously provided about $300 million annually, which is, you know, just over 10% of Gavi's total budget. And this declaration ends a prior U.S. pledge of $1 billion through 2030. And he says he's stopping all funding until this organization, quote, re-earns public trust.
Since Gavi's been founded in the year 2000, they've helped vaccinate over 1 billion children, and it's estimated that that has prevented nearly 20 million deaths. So thinking about the global good of this organization and then just to pull the funding is really sad because this is going to have an impact and children will die. Children will die.
Dr. Schreier, she's a pediatrician and a member of the House of Representatives from Washington State, brought this up and said that she was putting all vaccine preventable deaths in the United States on RFK Jr. And I think now we can put a lot of vaccine preventable deaths globally on RFK Jr.
Certainly, he is implicated in that with these decisions moving forward. And we're not even at the start of the meeting yet.
Not at the start of the meeting yet. As the meeting's starting, there's some rumors that are coming out. There's some rumblings on the internet. Historically, all the presentations at the meeting are vetted by CDC scientists, and they're posted online about a week or so ahead of the meeting, including all of the slides.
And I used to work with the CDC. I have worked on presentations with them, and to share information in a CDC meeting, it has to go through extensive scientific vetting and review. It's not like you just make a slide deck and show up. There really is a formal process to ensure that the CDC is only putting out the best and most factual information out there. So this is in line with how the CDC has always done things.
There are concerns that two of the presentations were not edited appropriately by CDC before being posted.
Oh no. Do I even want to know whose?
So the first is Lynn Redwood's presentation. She is the former president of the Children's Health Defense. That might ring a bell because the Children's Health Defense is the anti-vaccine advocacy group that RFK Jr. used to chair. The other presentation was from Dr. Martin Kulldorff. He is one of the new members of the ACIP, and he is the new ACIP chair.
My understanding is that when Lynn Redwood's presentation was then posted online afterwards, there was a fake citation that people noticed. And we talk a lot about fake citations in our earlier episode about the MAHA report, because that had a number of fake citations. And all of a sudden, that presentation was taken down, the fake citation was removed, and then put right back up. So, yeah.
Concerns. So all this happened before the meeting started. We're starting on a great foot.
I feel like we need that Love Island theme music. You know, between episodes, they have the catching you up on all the drama, what happened while you were away, and then you get right into the drama again. Now we're going to dive right back into the drama of the actual meeting itself.
So it started with technical issues.
No.
It started with technical issues. It started with Zoom issues. There were some people on mute. It was like every single Zoom meeting you've ever been to.
It just sounds like amateur hour.
It did not feel great.
Oh.
And then all the new members introduced themselves briefly. And then the new chair, Dr. Martin Kulldorff, gave kind of a brief summary of some of the changes that he was making. He started off kind of really setting the tone for the meeting, saying things like, vaccines are not all good or all bad. And that he, quotes, wants to hear both the majority and minority views. This idea that you have to give equal light to both sides of an issue, even when one side is not factually accurate, is something that has come up a lot in journalism. But we're at a scientific meeting. Do we give equal time? Do we give any time to things that have been disproven that are not scientifically accurate? Like, to start the meeting on that gave me the ick.
And then he moved forward by announcing two new work groups. The first is going to focus on the current vaccine schedule, which he said we needed to review because, quote, the number of vaccines that our children and adolescents receive today exceed what children in most other developed nations receive and what most of us in the room received when we were children. This gets again to this idea that they just think there's too many. The number is too high, too many.
He specifically labels that this group is going to talk about cumulative effect, which is something that all meeting he keeps bringing up, the cumulative effect of vaccines, the interactions between vaccines, the total number, the cumulative amounts of ingredients, the relative timing. And he just keeps saying that tweens are getting too many vaccines. There's too many, and that this is bad for you because there are more antigen exposures. This is, in fact, false. In 1980, children under two received vaccines to protect against seven diseases. These vaccines targeted 3,000 antigens, more or less. Currently, we protect against 15 diseases, and they target 150 antigens.
It sounds like science is getting better and more specific.
Like, less likely to have a autoimmune response because we're targeting a lot less antigens. So yes, we have more vaccines because we have better science. So this idea that he keeps reiterating that we're getting too many vaccines and too much exposure, we're actually getting less exposure than we were when he got his vaccines.
And then the second of these work groups is going to be focused on reviewing vaccines that haven't been reviewed for more than 7 years. And he was specifically thinking about the newborn hepatitis B vaccine, as well as our favorite vaccine, the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella. The hatred for that vaccine just won't die.
The hepatitis B vaccine and the MMR vaccines are the two vaccines that I think are most commonly talked about in anti-vax groups. There's this idea that the newborn hepatitis B vaccine is only needed in high-risk groups.
Essentially, hepatitis B is a blood-borne illness that causes liver disease. And sometimes it's just a rapid liver disease that your body clears on its own. Other times it can stay and be a chronic disease that causes liver failure and can cause death. The younger you are when you get it, the more likely you are to develop that more dangerous version, that chronic version. So it's recommended that all children be vaccinated at birth to prevent hepatitis B. And the controversy has been that people say, oh, if this mom isn't high risk for hepatitis B, which is a bloodborne illness, then the child shouldn't need it.
Dr. Kuhldorf specifically brought up this idea of, should we defer this vaccine from birth to 6 months? And that's something that's commonly brought up. I think what's really interesting is that the United States has been on a path to eliminate perinatal hepatitis B. We have been so successful at reducing neonatal hepatitis B that, in fact, in 2022, there were only 13 cases.
So the vaccine is working?
The vaccine is working.
And the idea is that they just want to remove the birth dose and then push it to 6 months. And there are concerns about that because transmission from the mom to the baby is globally the most common way that hepatitis B is transmitted. And that also children can get hepatitis B in other ways. And so with a bloodborne illness, people are often thinking about sharing needles or sexual contact. But hepatitis B is this hardy virus. It survives on surfaces for 7 days with the virus still replicating. So even if you know that the mom does not have hepatitis B and that there's no risk of transmission at the time of birth, it's still possible that a child could be exposed in the first 6 months of their life to some environmental contaminant containing hepatitis B that would put them at risk. And so this birth dose prevents both the vertical transmission, any other type of transmission that could happen, as well as preventing chronic liver disease and cancer related to hepatitis B.
You were telling me that there have been studies showing that hepatitis B has been found active on school lunch tables, on walls, on floors. It is thriving in our environment, and it can be found in all sorts of places.
When I worked with the CDC, hepatitis B was one of the programs that we focused on. And I was stationed out in Alaska, and they had done studies before the hepatitis B vaccine was available, trying to understand how all these kids were getting hepatitis B. And they swabbed surfaces in a school, like the lunch tables, the ceilings, the walls. Hepatitis B was everywhere.
Whoa.
I know. And now that's no longer the case, both because fewer people have hepatitis B since they're protected against it from this birth dose. And then because of that, there's less hepatitis B in the environment, and then you're less likely to get it. And vaccines against hepatitis B was actually some of the vaccines that Dr. Bill Cassidy, that senator that leads the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, was most supportive of. And so we're bringing up this idea that it needs to be re-reviewed.
So that was the first 5 minutes of the meeting.
Oh.
And then the rest of the meeting was divided into these major blocks by specific vaccines, covering COVID-19 vaccines, RSV or respiratory syncytial virus, influenza virus, and then kind of a handful of other viruses. chikungunya, anthrax, and the MMRV, mumps, measles, rubella, and varicella.
Let's get started. COVID?
Let's get started with COVID.
Let's do it.
It was a very dense few hours that started with presentations on the epidemiology, the vaccine safety, the vaccine uptake, and all of these presentations were given by doctorate-level CDC scientists.
So some of these presentations focused on how hospitalization rates are highest in kids under 6 months, adults over 70, those who are most susceptible to severe COVID illness, the youngest and the oldest. So most of the kids who are hospitalized from COVID are kids under 2. And most of the kids who require ICU level care are unvaccinated. In addition to the burden on those kids under 2, it's also clear that a lot of COVID burden is affecting adults. 70% of deaths are occurring in adults over 65. So we're still having a lot of COVID transmission. We're having impacts on the youngest and the oldest. And overall, the takeaway from these discussions seems to be that instead of ACIP wanting to target everyone with a COVID vaccine, they're coming out with more targeted recommendations that higher risk groups only should be vaccinated.
Usually during this ACIP meeting, it ends with a vote where they vote about recommendations. They vote about who should be getting the COVID vaccine in the next year. They vote about, should this be universal? Should this be targeted? There was no vote for COVID-19.
What?
There was no scheduled vote because RFK Jr. unilaterally made his decision before the meeting.
That's right. A few weeks ago, RFK Jr. made the announcement that he was changing the vaccine recommendations for COVID-19, for pregnant women and young children on his own without waiting for this ACIP meeting.
He will maintain the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommendations without changes.
I didn't see that statement by Senator Cassidy. I've only heard it from you, but if he said that I agreed to it, it would be inaccurate.
This is really a change from the more transparent, consensus-driven way that vaccine schedules are usually made. And then it's also, to me, pretty notable because he was removing the recommendations for vaccination of pregnant women and young kids. But these presentations realize that unvaccinated kids, particularly those under 2, are at highest risk of needing ICU-level care. So it really didn't seem like his decision aligned with the science.
His decision really didn't align with the science. Essentially, the ACIP members chatted a lot about the COVID vaccine, but they weren't voting. They weren't making any decisions. There were a couple of really interesting quotes, I think, that came out. I think Dr. Hibbelin really put it best. He said, quote, "The risk of an adverse event, for example, death from getting a vaccination is zero. And by broad strokes, the benefits of getting vaccination is 40 to 50% reduction of risk."
It sounds like I would want that. But you know what? The decision was made. People didn't get to vote. We talked about some science. We reflected on it. And then we went with a decision that had been made before the meeting by a non-scientist. Check. COVID-19, check. Moving on. The next topic that they tackled were the RSV vaccines.
So we've talked about the RSV vaccines before. So RSV is respiratory syncytial virus. It has a large burden in very young kids and causes a very high proportion of hospitalization in children.
We talked about how the NIH and the FDA and other parts of HHS work together to make this life-saving vaccine available. And we talked about that in our second episode about how HHS works.
There previously was two different types of RSV vaccines. The first was given to pregnant people to help pass on antibodies to a fetus. And the second is a monoclonal antibody given to newborns or infants under 8 months. Just a few weeks ago, the FDA approved a second monoclonal antibody. And so this meeting was supposed to vote on whether or not to recommend this new monoclonal antibody, clesrovimab, because I totally know how to say it.
I'm not going to even try. So they were supposed to vote on the first day with Dr. Cody Meissner, an ACIP member, saying, "People need to understand what a spectacular accomplishment these results are. And I just need to agree, because we started practicing medicine at a time before these were available, and my daughter was too old to get these shots by one day."
I was so mad.
And I was just worried because RSV causes a lot of morbidity and mortality in young children. And it's so wonderful that parents have this extra layer of protection now.
I feel like anybody who is anti-RSV vaccine just needs to spend like one day in the emergency department with me in the winter.
It is RSV season. And if they do spend a day there, they will get RSV.
Oh, 100% they will get RSV.
It's everywhere. This is, it's on the walls. No, that's not how RSV is transmitted. But I just think this is such a remarkable vaccine. And it was a little concerning when at the end of the first day, when they were supposed to vote on this, they
deferred. They deferred due to time.
Ooh, time. They deferred. But ultimately, on the second day, they did vote to approve this vaccine.
So they approved the use of this new clesrovimab to be used in infants younger than 8 months old, born during and entering the first RSV season. And they ultimately approved it for the Vaccine for Children program, which is the program that provides vaccine for more than 50% of children in the United States. While they approved the RSV vaccine, it felt like they were doing the right thing for the wrong reasons.
So 5 people voted yes, but 2 people voted no.
Dr. Levi made some statements that he needed to take the perspective of a parent and not a scientist. What would he feel like if we were telling him to do this for his children? He has 6 children, and he made statements saying that if my child was not healthy, they were born prematurely, they had congenital cardiac disease, like, absolutely. But if I have a healthy child, I don't think I'm ready to say yes yet, and we need more science, we need more data. And he kept advocating for different types of trials, and so he voted no.
Oh, I mean, this more science, the more data. Like, the science is right there. They just shared it. It is remarkable results. If you can't see that, like, I don't know. And then the second person who voted no was Dr. Pebsworth.
Even though Dr. Levi and Dr. Pebsworth voted no on the approval of the vaccine, they did ultimately vote yes on approving it for the Vaccine for Children program, stating that it needed to be equitable access for everybody.
So it sounds like there's 2 steps to this. One, which is, are we going to approve the vaccine, yes or no, which it went forward with 5 yeses and 2 noes. And then are we going to add it to what's called the Vaccines for Children?
The Vaccine for Children's program is a vaccination program in the United States that provides vaccines for more than 50% of children in the United States. The Vaccine for Children's program affects the cost barriers for vaccines. Monoclonal antibodies are expensive, and this addresses equity, making sure that everyone has the same access and the same right to vaccines.
So even though these 2 members didn't think this vaccine should be approved, once it was approved without their support, they decided that it would be important for equity to make sure everyone could get it.
The concerning part that happened during this vote was that it seemed like multiple members, including Dr. Malone, did not know what the Vaccine for Children's program was and did not know that they needed to vote on it.
Oh, fun. It's good to learn on the job.
Fun.
So fun. I mean, I didn't know what it was, but I'm not an ACIP member. That's 2 very different things. When you're an ACIP member and this is part of your job, you should at least know what it is.
It makes me concerned about the qualifications of these members, that they were handpicked, and that they're kind of ultimately unqualified to make vaccine policy decisions for our children when they don't even know about the program that provides vaccines for more than 50% of children in the United States. So overall, while they made the decision to approve this new RSV vaccine, which is very exciting, the whole discussion and the way that this was approved felt like an effort to build distrust into vaccines. It felt like it wasn't a big win for vaccines in America. Like the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, have said, don't be fooled by their vote to approve this vaccine.
And now we move on to influenza, or the flu vaccine. Should be easy, right?
Should be so easy. The vaccine has been out for so many years.
Decades. Longer than I've been alive, right?
Likely. When was the first year
of the flu vaccine? We're gonna about to find out how old I am.
It was developed for military use during World War II. So it is older than a lot of people.
It might be older than our parents.
It is.
Not only is older than me, it's older than our parents.
So influenza started very similarly to COVID. They talked about safety, epidemiology, vaccine update. And then they listed the proposed recommendations for the 2025 to 2026 influenza season.
And in this, they really focused on, you know, who, like with COVID, who is the most ill from the flu? And similarly, it's the young and the old. I'm not going to say the very old. I'm just going to say the
older.
Older.
Our parents are in that group. The young, wise, over 65 group.
Yeah, like the new 50, which is 65 and older. So these are the groups that experience the most morbidity and mortality from the flu. And one concerning thing is that this past year, we had a pretty bad flu season. It was ranked as high severity for all age groups, with the highest disease burden that there had been in the last 15 years. And across the country last year, 250 kids died of influenza. And about 90% of the kids who died from the flu were not fully vaccinated. But don't worry, Dr. Malone had something to say about this.
He said, quote, "Let's acknowledge this is a modest number."
What? 250 kids, about 90% of whom are not vaccinated against the flu, are dying of the flu, and you're saying that's modest? I understand that there are a lot of children in America, and that might seem like a small number, but that is a stunning amount of grief for what is a vaccine-preventable illness.
That number should be zero. There should be zero preventable deaths in children. And so the fact that you're accepting 250 makes me wonder, like, what is the number that you think is concerning? How many preventable deaths is acceptable? Because it should be zero.
How many kids do you want to see die of the flu, of measles, of COVID before you decide that it's the right time to do something? And just let us know what that number is. And when that number of children have died in this country, then maybe we'll change vaccine policy. That just seems so backwards. The point of these vaccines is to keep that number low.
Oh, don't worry. He is on the working group for the flu vaccine, and we'll be working on the flu vaccine in more detail for the months to come. He made lots of statements during this time period, including, quote, "I wanted to highlight that the flu vaccine is free of human fetal tissue derivative."
Was anybody asking?
He asked it as a question and then reiterated that he was highlighting this because people are worried about it.
Never heard anybody be worried about that. That was a weird thing to say.
It's a super weird thing to say. Super weird thing to say.
Another weird place that they really got hung up was on thimerosal.
Yeah. So half of the time dedicated to influenza was dedicated to thimerosal in vaccines, which we have talked about before.
So thimerosal is a preservative that's used in a small number of flu vaccines. And basically, it's something that's added to certain types of flu vaccines to just help it last longer.
So there was a presentation on thimerosal that was made by Lynn Redwood, who we talked about earlier because her presentation likely was not vetted by the CDC.
Oh, this is the one with the fake citation.
Yeah, this is the presentation with the fake citation. So she's the former president of the Children's Health Defense, that vaccine advocacy group that RFK Jr. was a part of. And she started her presentation by saying, "I'm a citizen. I don't represent any group." So I'm like, how did she manage to get a spot where all other public comments were 3 minutes? How did she manage to get a presentation? And it's that she secured a spot on the schedule after being appointed to the CDC advisory role by RFK Jr. specifically.
Oh, cool.
So like no conflicts of interest at all.
None.
So she gave this presentation on thimerosal, and there's a lot of history about thimerosal, which we've talked about in the past.
There was the hoax saying that thimerosal was part of what could cause this autism link, and we review that in detail in our vaccine autism hoax episode. But essentially, thimerosal has been removed from childhood vaccinations in America, just out of caution, even though this was a hoax and there is no link.
So her presentation goes on about neurotoxicity and other claims about thimerosal in vaccines, all of which has been debunked previously. And it's important to note that thimerosal is used in a very, very, very small fraction of vaccines. So in the 1990s, when there was this concern that maybe thimerosal could lead to neurotoxic effects, manufacturers voluntarily removed it from vaccines, all childhood vaccines, and the majority of vaccines given to adults.
So although there was never any established link, there was a period of time that it was being investigated. And during that period of time, it was removed from all childhood vaccines. And now it's not even in vaccines. And yet this remains a big source of conflict for some reason.
Spend hours on it at this meeting, despite the fact that about 96% of all flu vaccines in the U.S. are thimerosal free in the last year. And the concern is really about pregnant women. Like if you don't know that you're pregnant and you get the flu vaccine And they calculated that in 2024, it was about 0.3% of pregnant women received vaccines with thimerosal. So we're talking about a very, very, very small percentage. My favorite quote of the whole meeting comes out of this. Dr. Meisner, the only ACIP member that had previously been on the ACIP, said, "I'm not sure how to respond to this presentation. This is an old issue that has been addressed in the past." He goes on to say, of all the issues the ACIP needs to focus on, this is not a big issue. He states that, "I think it's important to note that there is no study that has ever indicated any harm from thimerosal." He talks about the fact that thimerosal is in most vaccines that are given globally because we're so fixated on what happens internationally, and ends up being the only person, spoiler, to recommend continuing vaccines with thimerosal in them.
That's right, because the issue about thimerosal is not so much about America, since it's been removed from the vast majority of vaccines given in America, but it is still used as a preservative for vaccines that are distributed globally.
So it's used in multi-dose influenza vaccines. So if you have a large bottle that has like 10 doses in it, that's when there's thimerosal in it.
And that helps preserve it, and that helps people in more rural areas, in harder to reach areas, have access to a flu vaccine. So when they're debating this and ultimately, like Alicia says, vote to remove thimerosal from vaccines, that is going to affect the global distribution and availability of vaccines more than it's going to affect anything in the United States. And it's also worth noting that this is an FDA issue, a Food Drug Administration issue, not an ACIP issue. And yet they still do this.
The FDA is the organization that approves what goes in. The ACIP is the organization that recommends whether or not to give vaccines and what the timing should be. They should not be deciding what's in a vaccine.
And here we are.
Here we are. They voted on the 26th about whether or not to approve annual flu shots and whether or not these flu shots should be thimerosal free. They voted for children, for pregnant women, and for adults separately. And for all three votes, it was voted that all flu vaccines should be thimerosal free. The votes were 5-1. Dr. Meisner was the one vote no. And fascinatingly, Dr. Pebsworth abstained.
Interesting, interesting. But we just want to give a shout out to Dr. Meisner just for following the science. So congratulations. There's never been a single study showing any harm. And this is just going to affect equity. And I thought equity was something they really cared about.
He actually brought up some amazing points. He, shout out to him throughout the meeting, made some excellent points. And he made comments of the risk of thimerosal. There is none that we know of. The risk of not getting a flu vaccine is high. Why would we prevent someone from getting a flu vaccine for a non-existent risk of thimerosal? And like 100%, 100%.
Absolutely.
Fascinatingly, Dr. Pebsworth abstained. And then later she commented, she abstained because she thought all vaccines should be thimerosal free, but she didn't think that everyone needed a vaccine. And the way that it was worded was that like recommending universal vaccinations that are thimerosal free. And so she wanted not universal vaccinations. She did not want to vote yes on vaccines.
Okay. I don't know what to make of that, but it sounds like we don't have some conflict-free people. It sounds like we have some people who have pre-existing views. The next part of the meeting talked about vaccines for chikungunya and anthrax. They were discussed, but there was no votes scheduled. So we're going to skim over that because it was a long meeting, and we'll come back if and when there's a vote. And then we want to end by talking about the MMRV vaccine, which is the measles, mumps, rubella, and varicella, or chickenpox vaccine.
So there's two versions of this vaccine right now. There's the MMRV, which is a combined vaccine of all four of those viruses. And there is, before the chickenpox vaccine existed, it was MMR. And so you can give them separately. You can give the MMR vaccine and the varicella vaccine differently. When the MMRV was created, after it was approved, they noticed an increased risk of febrile seizures after the first dose of the MMRV vaccine. Febrile seizures
are terrifying as a parent, but are also common and have no long-term morbidity or mortality for most kids. 1/3 of kids will have a febrile seizure in their lifetime, and then they often go on and never have any subsequent impact of that.
It is not an increased risk of developing epilepsy in your lifetime, And they tend to be genetic. So if you had a febrile seizure as a kid, your children are more likely to have them. About a third of children have febrile seizures in the lifetime. About 50% of those go on to have another one. It is a really common childhood ailment. They're terrifying to see, but overall not dangerous. When this data came out, the ACIP met about it. There are some recommendations of like, should we recommend the MMR? Should we recommend the MMRV? And essentially, they're currently like both recommended. Like any way that you can get vaccines is great.
Just get it. Get the MMRV or get the MMR and separately get the V. Whatever. Do in whatever way you want. Get the vaccines, but they didn't make a specific recommendation on which one. They said either one.
Dr. Kuhldorf ended the meeting saying that he doesn't understand why the MMRV would be offered with this known risk of febrile seizures for children under 47 months, which is have the highest risk of febrile seizures. And that at the next meeting, he wants to propose that only the MMR should be offered, not the MMRV.
Cool. Cool. I mean, we're in the midst of this measles outbreak in America, which is mostly affecting people that are unvaccinated against measles. And then we're bringing up these fears around the measles vaccination that isn't related to the measles component at all. So it was pretty surprising that this popped up on the agenda because there's not any new data right now. But it's definitely setting the tone for what it sounds like they're going to do next.
I also think it's interesting that it's coming from Dr. Kuhldorf, who made multiple statements throughout the meeting about how he's concerned that there's too many vaccines. And so he wants to go from one vaccine to two vaccines, but he also thinks we currently have too many vaccines. So, like, what does that mean for the future of vaccines and how many does he want to cut?
Yeah, I mean, if they're concerned about the number, this does seem like an odd thing where you're trying to increase the number. But, you know, I don't know how to read their minds. It doesn't really make any sense. Other things that were surprising about this meeting is that they were supposed to talk about the HPV vaccine and the pneumonia vaccines, and they were dropped from the schedule. So that's TBD. That'll come up some other time, I'm sure. But overall, the tone of this meeting, you know, on the one hand, vaccines were approved.
They approved the annual flu shot with some asterisks.
With an asterisk. The COVID decision was already made. So, you know, they made decisions that overall were mostly good, but in ways that really helped grow public mistrust in vaccines by giving a lot of time, a lot of airwaves, a lot of quote to these non-scientific fears around vaccines, which really legitimizes it when it comes from ACIP. So, like, good job approving the vaccines, but you did it in a way that really elevated vaccine misinformation in a way that's going to keep spreading now and could ultimately really harm vaccine uptake.
I felt like if you read the 3-second summary versus if you watched quotes or sections or, like me, watched the whole committee meeting, it feels very different.
Shout out to Alicia for watching that.
It was physically painful to my soul.
Because people are just repeating lies and hoaxes and mistruths. And eventually they vote in a way to approve a vaccine, which is, you know, what the science shows. But in between that, they spread so much misinformation. And once it's out there, families are hearing that. The public is hearing that. It's being given this weight that these lies don't deserve.
So optimistic. What a note to end on.
I'm not going to promise any more positive health news because ever since I did that, it got dark.
Positive RSV vaccine, second monoclonal, is it even a vaccine? Second monoclonal antibody approved in the U.S. today by the ACIP. It still needs to be forwarded to the CDC director, which we still don't have.
Cool.
Cool, cool, cool. For it to be on the childhood vaccination schedule. Also, RFK Jr. has just been making his own decisions separate from this committee, separate from the CDC. So was this meeting even worthwhile? Is he even going to follow these? Nobody knows.
I mean, Dr. Cassidy thought he knew.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think RFK Jr. called Dr. Cassidy a liar.
Ooh, all right. Rolling forward, Dr. Sister Science Facts. So that concludes this episode of Love Island. I mean, the Rolling Forward podcast.
I'm Dr. Lisa Rowland.
I'm Dr. Stephanie Rowland.
Shoot us an email at rollinforwardshow, R-O-L-I-N, forwardshow@gmail.com.
and let us know. Did you watch this? Do you have thoughts about this? Because we'd love to hear what you think.
There was so much to talk about that we couldn't talk about all the juicy moments. If you have a favorite one, let us know.
Yeah, well, we would love that. Take care. Going forward, Dr. Sister Science.